Hello, and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robin Conrad, the Director of Research and Special Projects at the Death Penalty Information Center. Today, I will be speaking with our Executive Director, Robert Dunham, to discuss DPIC's 2016 year-end report. To start off the podcast, Robert, please tell our listeners what the key findings are from DPIC's year-end report.
I think perhaps the most important fact from this year is that in 2016, there were fewer new death sentences imposed than at any time in the modern era of the United States death penalty. And that dates back to 1972 when the United States Supreme Court declared the death penalty to be unconstitutional. So we will have fewer new death sentences imposed than at any other time in the modern era. And we're projecting 30 new death sentences in 2016. That's also down 39% from last year, which was already a 40-year low. At the same time that new death sentences were down, executions were down to levels unseen since 1991. There were 20 executions in 2016. And they were imposed, they were carried out by only five states, which is the lowest number of states to carry out any executions since the late 1980s. And at the same time that this was happening, we saw the courts overturning a number of improper practices that had disproportionately produced death sentences in four different states. And the public opinion polls showed that support for the death penalty was also at historic lows. Both Pew and Gallup had support for the death penalty listed at the lowest levels in 40 years and opposition higher than at any time since before the U.S. Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional.
We have seen the drop in new death sentences and executions, which reflects the public's growing discomfort with the death penalty. But in 2016, we also saw that three states had ballot initiatives in which voters chose to retain capital punishment. What do these elections results mean for the death penalty in 2016 and moving forward?
Well, I think the election results show that the United States continues to have deep divisions in its thoughts about capital punishment. And it also shows that the public has a much more nuanced view of the death penalty than it usually is given credit for. Obviously, the most highly publicized election results this year were the state referenda in Nebraska, California, and Oklahoma. In which Nebraska voters overturned the state legislature's repeal of the capital punishment statute. And California voters voted down an effort to repeal the death penalty and at the same time very narrowly approved a question that billed itself as shortening the appellate process. In Oklahoma, there was a voter referendum on putting the death penalty in the state's constitution. There wasn't very much debate about it one way or the other, and it was relatively uncontroversial and passed. So if you took a look at those three things, you would say that perhaps there was a change in public attitudes about the death penalty. But then when you look at the margins in those states and the overall public opinion polling nationwide, what you see reflects nothing surprising at all. In Oklahoma, 66% of the public voted in favor of the death penalty referendum. That is 6 percentage points below what the polls say support for the death penalty would be in that state. 72% of people responding to an Oklahoma poll by the Sooner Poll Organization, 72% said that they supported the death penalty, but 66% voted for this referendum. And in Nebraska, the support for the referendum was 60%, still a solid number, but when you look at the overall number from Gallup saying that 60% supported the death penalty, and the Pew number of 49%, in a more politically conservative state, that level of support isn't surprising. California was a close vote, less than 52% to 48%, and that is also in line with what the general polls would have you expect. When you look at what happened elsewhere, you see this was not a repudiation of the long-term change in public opinion about the death penalty. voters were indicating that they are dissatisfied with the way in which the death penalty is being carried out. And they don't want the death penalty to be aggressively carried out, overly aggressively carried out. They voted in favor of governors in two states who had imposed moratoria on the death penalty, saying that execution should not move forward while the death penalty was still being administered in a manner that was arbitrary and unfair. And when it came to local county races, there were elections in a number of the counties that had produced the most death sentences in the country between 2010 and 2015. Four of the prosecutors in those counties, four of the counties that imposed more death sentences than almost any other county in the United States, had district attorney elections in which the voters voted out prosecutors who had been associated with the overly aggressive use of the death penalty, and voted in prosecutors who said that either they were personally opposed to the death penalty or they were going to use it much, much more sparingly. And in the state of Kansas, pro-death penalty forces had sought to oust four separate justices who had voted over the course of time to overturn a number of death sentences in that state. And what we saw there was that all four of those justices were retained. So there really was a mixed view from the voters. The big statewide referenda turned out in favor of proponents of the death penalty, but a large number of state and local elections said that voters have had enough with the overly aggressive enforcement of the death penalty.
It sounds like what we're hearing is that there's still the decline with the death penalty, and public opinion is on the decline, and the election results are varied.
The election results are mixed, and the one thing we know for certain is what actually happened.
Right.
What actually happened is that fewer states were pursuing death sentences, fewer states returned death sentences, fewer counties imposed death sentences, down more than half in just 4 years. There were only 27 counties in the more than 3,000 counties in the United States that sentenced anyone to death. And we see a geographic concentration in the new death sentences in a small number of counties that historically have disproportionately sought and obtained the death penalty. What's interesting there, too, is that in 2013, we did a report called the 2% death penalty that showed that fewer than 2% of all the counties in the United States accounted for more than 56% of all the death sentences that were imposed in the country. And we saw that same concentration this year, that even with reduced number of death sentences, 60% of them were from those 2% counties. So there is this increasingly geographic isolation in the use of the death penalty. Fewer and fewer counties are using it, but it's also being disproportionately used among this select county that overproduced the death penalty. Jurors are imposing death penalty less even in those counties, so they were down in death sentences by 35%. And voters in those counties are disaffected, and they voted out prosecutors in four of the major death penalty producing counties. So the numbers themselves show that death penalties are down at record levels, and they reflect the long-term trend. Because when you look at the long-term trends, the five-year trend, the 10-year trend in new death sentences, they have been consistently downward for the past 17 years. And we now have fewer new death sentences imposed in the United States in the past decade than in the 10 years before the U.S. Supreme Court declared the death penalty unconstitutional in 1972.
So does the fact that there are so few death sentences being imposed reflect this idea that prosecutors really are truly reserving that punishment and seeking the death penalty for only the worst of the worst criminals, so to speak, or, you know, the worst crimes? Is that what this reflects when we're seeing such a low number of death sentences being returned?
That's what you would want the numbers to reflect. You want the death penalty, if you're going to have it, to be reserved for the worst of the worst cases and the worst of the worst perpetrators. But that's not what the numbers show. When you look at the death penalty historically, if you had a list of the offenders and offenses and described what the offenses were. You had two lists, and one of them were everybody, the list of everybody who was sentenced to death, and another one was a list of everybody who was capitally charged but was sentenced to life. You would not be able to, taking a look at the two lists, identify which one was which. And this year, even though there are likely to be only 31 new death sentences, we've taken a quick look at those cases, and at least one-third of them are going to be defendants with significant evidence of mental illness, significant evidence of intellectual disabilities, or defendants who were young, under age 21, at the time of the offenses. The people with the kinds of impairments and the kinds of undeveloped judgment or impairments in judgment that the United States Supreme Court has already said don't make them the worst of the worst. And so the fact that death sentences are down has not reflected that they're being reserved for the worst of the worst.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the courts and what's happened in the courts this year. You know, in January of 2016, the Supreme Court issued an opinion in Hearst versus Florida, and that had a broad impact, obviously, on Florida and some other states. Would you tell our listeners about that decision and the impact that it's had throughout the country and on the death penalty generally?
Going into this year, there were three states in the United States that permitted judges to impose death sentences either over the wishes of a jury, and that's called judicial override, where they impose death sentences when a jury had returned a verdict for life or a recommendation for life, or impose death sentences when the jury had not reached a unanimous sentencing decision. At least one juror and as many as five may have voted for life. Well, a case came up to the U.S. Supreme Court called Hearst, and Timothy Hearst was a case in which there was a 7-5 vote by his jury.
7-5 vote for what?
That was a 7-5 vote for death in his jury. And the jury was not asked to mark down what facts it had found as to why he might deserve the death penalty. Those are called aggravating circumstances. And under the Constitution, there must be at least one aggravating circumstance, some reason the legislature has determined beyond just the commission of a murder that makes that murder subject to the death penalty. You couldn't tell from what the jury did what fact it had found. And in fact, with a 7-5 vote, it was possible that there were some jurors who hadn't found any aggravating circumstances to be present at all. The United States Supreme Court in Hearst said, the Sixth Amendment gives all defendants in criminal cases the right to have a jury. And the right to a jury trial carries with it the right to find all facts that are necessary before the person can be convicted. In a capital case, the defendant has the right to have a jury find all facts that are necessary before a death penalty can be imposed. And when we're looking through that lens, they said, we don't have to go any further in the Hearst case than to say that we don't know what facts the jury found in this case. And in fact, it doesn't matter because the judge found facts on his own. And that's unconstitutional. Because Florida did not require the jury find all facts necessary to impose a death penalty, their statute is unconstitutional. Florida hasn't decided how broadly it's going to apply the Hearst decision. But the legislature knew that if it wanted to have a death penalty, it was going to have to enact some kind of a fix. And it could do one of a couple of things. It could act very narrowly and just say that the juries were required to find an aggravating circumstance, some fact that would make the defendant eligible for the death penalty, or they could respond more broadly to the concerns that were clearly expressed in the language of Hearst, that a death penalty would be unconstitutional unless juries found all facts that would make a defendant, that could make the defendant subject to the death penalty. One of the facts that a jury finds is whether aggravating circumstances exist, whether a person is eligible for the death penalty. Another set of facts that the jury might find is whether the aggravating circumstances are serious enough to warrant consideration of the death penalty, even if the defendant was eligible for the death penalty. And another set of facts that the jury might be required to find would be that the reasons for death outweighed the reasons for life. Those are all questions that are present in the death penalty statutes in Delaware and Florida and in Alabama. After Hearst was decided, the Delaware Supreme Court declared its statute unconstitutional, in part because it allowed for a non-unanimous vote of the jury. The judge could impose the death penalty without a unanimous recommendation from the jury for death. So Delaware declared its statute unconstitutional and later decided that everybody who was sentenced to death under that statute should have their death sentences converted to life without possibility of parole. That, when you take the people who were on death row and were facing capital retrials, that took 17 people off of death row, making them ineligible for execution. The Florida Supreme Court took a look at the new statute that was passed by the Florida legislature. That statute said you've got to find an aggravating circumstance, but it did not say you had to have a unanimous jury determination of death. It allowed death penalties to be imposed if there were 10 or more votes, so you could still have a non-unanimous jury recommendation for death. The Florida court said that violated Hearst and the state constitution, which means that the new death penalty statute is unconstitutional. It also means that the people who were sentenced to death previously, whether or not they had questions about whether the jury found aggravating circumstances or not, if they were sentenced to death under a system of judge overriding a jury recommendation for life or judge imposing death with a non-unanimous jury recommendation, all those death sentences were unconstitutional. They still have not decided how broadly they're going to apply that ruling either. And just the other day, late in December, the Alabama courts, having been directed by the U.S. Supreme Court to take a look at the issue, decided there was nothing wrong constitutionally with their statute. They said that the aggravating circumstances were found during the guilt verdict. They said that Hearst, as decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, only dealt with the question of death eligibility, and that the finding of whether aggravating circumstances outweighed mitigating circumstances, well, that wasn't a finding at all, at least under the Sixth Amendment. And they said that the judicial override of life verdicts was okay, and judicial death sentence with non-unanimous death sentences, death recommendations was also okay.
So as of now, at the close of 2016, it looks like Delaware doesn't have a current death penalty. Is that correct?
That's right. And the Delaware legislature was very close to abolishing the death penalty. In fact, death penalty abolition had passed the state Senate, had been reported to the floor of the House, where it initially narrowly failed and was going to be up for reconsideration. But the legislature then withheld, deferred voting on reconsideration to give the Supreme Court a chance to act. The state Supreme Court declared the statute unconstitutional, and there are very few prospects that the legislature will attempt to bring back the death penalty. The governor is opposed to it, and at least one house of the legislature will not support bringing it back.
And then Florida remains an unknown. We're still waiting to hear how the law that was struck down is going to apply to all of the prisoners who are currently on death row, right?
We know that Florida has a problem with arbitrariness because 400 people at least have been unconstitutionally sentenced to death. That leads to another question of arbitrariness, which is, will they enforce the Constitution and afford all of the people who are sent to death row the same constitutional rights, or are they going to arbitrarily distinguish between sets of defendants based on what year they were sentenced to death? One may be permissible in terms of carrying out the death penalty. They may be able to say it will retroactively apply to some people and not others, or say it's only going to apply going forward. But if that's the case, then it means that they're going to tolerate the execution of potentially more than 100, more than 200 individuals whom they know did not receive fair trials.
And then Alabama remains an outlier in that it's finding that its statute is constitutional under the Hearst decision by the United States Supreme Court, correct?
Alabama remains not only an outlier, but even more of an outlier, because now it stands alone as the only state that permits judicial override, the only state that permits non-unanimous jury verdicts. And even if it survives constitutional review under the Sixth Amendment right to a jury, there's another constitutional theory under the Eighth Amendment that says that if a death penalty is imposed under practices that offend the evolving standards of decency, that offend an evolved national consensus about what the appropriate practices in death penalty cases should be, then it violates the Eighth Amendment. You can't get further out on the outlier limb than Alabama is today as the only state that allows this practice.
Let's talk briefly about the executions we saw in 2016. There were only 20 executions this year, which is the lowest number of executions we've seen in 25 years, and the fewest number of states have carried out executions since 1983. What do these executions tell us about the death penalty?
I think the execution numbers tell us a number of things. One is they too are on the decline, and it's a long-term decline. The executions were at the lowest they've been in a quarter century. Now, when you look at the new death sentences, that tells us a lot about the current state of the public opinion about the death penalty. It's a leading indicator, if you will. Executions are a lagging indicator. They tell us more about the problems in the past and the way courts react or don't react to possible constitutional problems. Executions are down in part because courts are granting relief in more cases. They are down in part because states are having trouble carrying out executions. They're down in part because the public isn't tolerating executions the way the public did 20 years ago. All of those things are the case. But what they're also telling us is that the courts have failed as a screening device to ensure that the death penalty is carried out only against the worst of the worst. Just as we had problems with the new death sentences, the Death Penalty Information Center has taken a quick look at the records of the 20 people who have been executed this year in 2016. With a quick look, we've seen that at least 12, that's 60% of the people who were executed, showed signs of significant evidence of mental illness, significant evidence of brain impairment, brain damage, and low intellectual functioning, some combination of those three. At least six of the prisoners had diagnoses of serious mental illness. At least five had evidence of brain damage. And 15%, three of them presented significant evidence of intellectual disability. These are people who probably with fair trials and good representation would not be sentenced to death today. The new death sentences are down significantly around the country, and the executions, in fact, show us that even in the states that are carrying out a lot of executions, death sentences are down. And that's a product of better representation. That's a product of juries being told that they have a life without parole option. They weren't told this in the 90s when a lot of the people who were executed this year were sentenced to death. In Georgia, they didn't have that option, and Georgia executed more people this year than any other state, nine, as compared with Texas, who also didn't inform juries in the 1990s that life without parole was an option, and Texas executed seven. Texas in the 1990s had a year in which they sent 48 people to death row. Texas, while executing 7 people this year, only imposed 4 new death sentences. And Georgia executed 9 prisoners this year, the most since the era of Jim Crow. But its juries didn't sentence anybody to death this year, nor did they sentence anybody to death last year. And when you looked at who got sentenced to death, again, Coy Westbrook was executed in Texas with compelling evidence of intellectual disability. Kenneth Foltz and John Connor were executed in Georgia despite compelling evidence of intellectual disability. And when you talk about cases that are the worst of the worst, it's fair to say that the executions in 2016 exemplified some of the worst miscarriages of justice, not necessarily the worst of the worst defendants. In Kenneth Foltz's case, you're talking about an African-American defendant who is sentenced to death in a case in which a juror admitted that once he pled guilty, he would vote for death because that's what the, and I'm not going to use the word, the N-word deserved. So you know that there are serious questions of racial bias in the case. We know the juror said that because he issued an affidavit, he signed an affidavit saying that. It was also the case that Foltz's own lawyer had been known for making bigoted comments in connection with another African-American defendant. He had described that defendant as a little, again, the N-word, who deserved the chair. And in that case, he had not even bothered to convey to his client an offer from the prosecution that the defendant be sentenced to life. In this case, that same lawyer who had expressed racial prejudice before, in this case, he never presented any evidence of Foltz's intellectual disability to the jury, and he, in fact, slept through significant portions of the trial. But despite these clear racial overtones, the state courts did not grant any relief, and neither did the federal courts.
The facts surrounding Mr. Foltz's conviction and sentence certainly demonstrate the ongoing problems with racism within the criminal legal system. What other concerns were reflected when DPIC examined the cases of people who were executed in 2016?
An ongoing theme in these cases of executions was that instead of heightened procedural safeguards, making sure that people whose lives were at stake received the utmost in judicial review and the constitutional protections that you would expect anybody to receive, that instead of that happening, you instead had people executed without ever obtaining federal judicial review of their cases. So 7 of the prisoners who were executed, 35% of them, never had a federal appeal of their cases. In order to have a federal appellate court review their case, you have to have what's called a certificate of appealability. And in 7 cases, defendants never got that. So you've got capital defendants who don't ever have a federal appeals court looking at the issues in their cases. In 3 of the cases, you had prisoners executed because their state appeals lawyers had either missed state filing deadlines or had improperly filed a state court appeal because they hadn't paid a filing fee. Now, if somebody's life is at stake, do you want the death penalty to be carried out because a lawyer failed to pay a filing fee or had failed to timely notify the courts that the defendant was indigent and didn't have to pay a filing fee? What we've seen is it's not the worst of the worst defendants who were executed in 2016. It was the most vulnerable of defendants with intellectual and emotional and mental impairments. It was defendants who received the worst representation and the least level of judicial scrutiny. And that is not something that instills confidence that the death penalty is being carried out in a fair and neutral and non-arbitrary way.
Although there were 20 executions carried out this year, it is worth mentioning that Texas, who typically has been the state leading the number of executions, actually granted quite a few stays of execution this year. Can you provide background on what happened in Texas and the circumstances surrounding the stays that were issued?
In Texas, there were seven cases that in which executions went forward. There were seven other cases in which the state courts granted a stay of execution to allow death row prisoners to litigate other claims. And this was largely the product of a change in law in the state after a series of both death row and non-capital prisoners were exonerated. The Texas legislature adopted a new innocence protection law that would allow defendants, that would allow prisoners who had gone through their appellate process and had no appeals left, to come back into state court with new evidence of innocence or new evidence of junk science in their case. If they had been sentenced to death or if they'd been convicted based upon what we now know was scientifically unreliable evidence, false scientific evidence or junk science. In four of the cases, that's what happened. In four of the cases, defendants presented new evidence that they were unable to present during the course of their normal appeals, that they hadn't discovered or had been withheld from them. The courts granted review in those cases. And importantly, that not only reduced the number of executions this year, but it pointed out problems in the past. Because in the past, these people would not have gotten stays of execution. They would have been executed despite strong evidence of innocence, despite strong evidence of essentially junk science being presented in their case. And one of the areas in which we've seen the junk science goes to the question of mental health testimony concerning whether a defendant poses a danger to society in the future. In one of the cases, Jeffrey Wood, an individual who never killed anybody, and he was never accused of actually committing the killing in the case in which he was sentenced to death. He was, at best, an accomplice to a robbery in which he didn't know that a killing would take place. So sitting out in the car, the co-defendant commits a robbery and commits a killing during the course of that robbery. So Jeff Wood is less culpable than a defendant who doesn't get the death penalty and never killed anybody. And the state presents a psychiatrist who testifies that Wood will certainly pose a danger of future violent acts if he's not sentenced to death. Jeff Wood has never been convicted of any act of violence in his life. And Dr. Grigson, the doctor that the state used, had not only been disciplined, he'd been expelled from the Texas Psychiatric Association. He'd been expelled from the American Psychiatric Association because of unethical practices in other capital cases, in which, like the Wood case, he testified that defendants would pose certain danger in the future, and he testified, as he did in the Wood case, without ever having evaluated the defendants himself, and without having reviewed any institutional records or mental health history of these defendants. And he did so just answering hypothetical questions that were posed by the prosecution. The medical associations have said that is completely scientifically invalid. They said it is unethical, and they expelled Grigson from the professional associations for doing that. And that was before the trial took place in this case. The prosecution didn't disclose it to the defense. The defense lawyers didn't investigate Grigson's background and didn't present that. And Wood would have been executed under past practices. But because of the new Texas law that allows new evidence of the unscientific nature of testimony to be challenged, he was able to raise a challenge, and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted a stay of execution to permit that appeal to go forward.
But if he were in another state, he may have been executed. Say, for example, Georgia or Alabama.
In another state, he very well would have been executed, yes. In states that aggressively enforce these hyper-technical procedural rules to make it so that the finality of a death sentence takes precedence over its accuracy and fairness. In states like that, people will be executed despite the same type of problems. And that's why in Ron Smith's case, he's executed despite the fact that there's a very serious constitutional question about whether somebody who never had a jury sentenced them to death should be executed.
Well, let me stop you right for a minute and explain to our listeners what you mean. What state was Ron sentenced to death in and what happened in his case?
So Ron Smith was tried and sentenced to death in Alabama. And as we mentioned earlier, Alabama is now the only state left in the country that allows a practice called judicial override. And that's a practice in which jurors recommend a life sentence, and the judge, despite the fact that the conscience of the community, as expressed by jurors who have already sworn that they're capable of imposing the death penalty in an appropriate case, these jurors have said this is not an appropriate case. The judge overrides that and imposes a death verdict. The issue is serious enough that four members of the United States Supreme Court wanted to grant a stay of execution so they could hear the issue. But under the Supreme Court rules, while four votes are enough to hold the case over, to have it fully briefed, and to have it argued, and to have it decided by the full court, four votes are not enough to grant a stay of execution. So Ron Smith is executed despite the fact that four members of the court wanted to hear his case.
Smith was the last person to be executed in 2016 here in the United States. And can you tell our listeners just very briefly about what happened with his execution that was using a three-drug protocol with the drug midazolam that has been used in several other botched executions. And we've seen that over the last few years.
Midazolam has been used in botched executions in Oklahoma, in Arizona, in Ohio. This year, there's significant evidence that midazolam failed and executions were botched in Alabama as well. In fact, at this point, I would almost say that you can't say that an execution with midazolam is botched because the results are what medical experts say you should expect. Here's the problem. In states that use multiple drug protocols, that is to say, they conduct the execution using a series of drugs, they typically use three different drugs, and the drugs are supposed to perform three different functions. The first function is to anesthetize the prisoner so that he or she does not feel pain when the killing drug is administered. The second drug is a paralytic agent. It serves no legitimate purpose during the course of the execution. It simply makes it so the body doesn't show a response. Some would say it's for the comfort of the witnesses, so they don't see involuntary body responses, the body thrashing around, or extreme crying out, or things along those lines. The third drug, typically a drug like potassium chloride, is the killing drug. And it is described as being akin to being chemically burned at the stake. In essence, the prisoner is burned to death chemically from the inside out, but should be immune to the pain because he's fully or she's fully anesthetized by the first drug. The problem with midazolam is it is not an anesthetic. It is an anti-anxiety drug and a sedative that in the medical community is inappropriate for the use in any kind of prolonged surgical proceeding or any proceeding that could involve pain. And the reason for that is that while midazolam may initially put you to sleep, it doesn't render you insensate. That is to say, you can still feel pain. And one of the ways in which that's shown is that when the painful killing drug is administered, person will be jolted back into consciousness. In Ron Smith's case, the eyewitnesses reported that he was gasping for air. One of the witnesses said to me that it looked like a guppy when it's taken out of water, trying to get air in. And it's that fish out of water description that we also saw in the Joseph Wood execution coming out of Arizona. So there is a clear description that the execution of Ron Smith takes 34 minutes. 15 minutes of that involves writhing, coughing, gasping like a fish out of water. It is what you by now should not be surprised to see when an anesthetic is not used, but a sedative that is incapable of maintaining unconsciousness when the killing drug is administered is used instead. It is another failed use of midazolam. And by now, it's clear that midazolam is an inappropriate drug to be using, and we can expect to see what we saw in the Alabama cases this year.
Given everything that's happened in 2016, how would you sum up this year in review for the death penalty in the United States?
I think 2016 shows that we are in the midst of a major political climate change on the issue of the death penalty. As with any form of climate change, whether it's physical or metaphorical, you're going to see it proceed in fits and starts with individual events that may not easily fit the pattern that you would expect. But when you step back, you see that there is a long-term pattern, and that long-term pattern is clear. The long-term pattern with the death penalty remains clear. There is a 20-plus year consistent pattern in which the number of death sentences is going down, the number of executions is going down, support for the death penalty as expressed in public opinion polls continues to drop, support for life without parole as an alternative continues to rise. All of that suggests that the death penalty may be becoming a thing of the past. When you look at the public opinion polls and you see that support for the death penalty is dropping across all demographic groups, but particularly among the young, it suggests that this may be a problem whose resolution isn't figured out by one side arguing with the other and persuading the other that one side is right and the other is wrong. It may be an issue much like the question of marriage equality, where it has a generational component, and we just outgrow it. And what we're seeing today is the younger generation of Americans not just saying that it has problems with the way the death penalty is being administered, but saying, why do we do this in the first place?
There you have it, our summary of DPIC's 2016 year-end report. Thank you all for listening to Discussions with DPIC. To read our year-end report and to learn more about the death penalty, visit our website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. To make sure that you receive every episode of our podcast, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice.